I'm not going to spend much time on homework. You did pretty well. Sometimes people didn't answer some of the questions I asked you, but you're getting better at that too. This week's is probably a bit of a struggle because of the Bayesian programs, but for those who have tried, have you been able to get some Bayesian program or other running? Good. And you might want to look at how, I think I may have asked about this, but if I didn't, it's worth looking at. How do the Bayesian support clade probabilities that you get, clade posterior probabilities that you get out of a Bayesian program, or partition posterior probabilities if it's an unrooted tree, how do those compare to the corresponding bootstrap values? And I think you'll find that where there were high bootstrap values, there are now much higher Bayesian posterior values. I like to say that the Bayesian ones are wrong, but I'm afraid it's the bootstrap ones that are biased downwards, generally speaking. When low, they're biased upwards, which led one statistician analyzing it to say, well, there's no bias, but the ones you care about are the high ones, and they're biased downwards. Okay. What we're going to do is whiz through some stuff on trees from gene frequencies, because we're a little bit behind, and also, see, this is all stuff you've seen. Sorry. It goes on and on and on. If you look at the screen, you'll be gradually blinded. This is probably a question about something before what I'm going to talk about, right?
If the Bayesian, or if the bootstrap values are biased upwards, when they're low, then biased downwards when they're high, does that mean that the method is inconsistent?
Well, the problem is, I think if you look at the formal statistical definition of inconsistency, you can't really apply it to this case. Because if you've got a large amount of data with larger and larger and larger amounts of data, what will happen is that the estimation method will ultimately arrive inside this part of the space that's that tree, the correct tree topology. And it will then converge. And bootstrap values you get from it will also tend to go, they'll tend to go to the right groups and go to 100%. So in that sense, it's consistent. But it's not very interesting. I mean, knowing that the tree ultimately, if the model is right, which is always the big if for all of these methods, then you converge on the correct tree, the estimation is consistent. Then if you ask further about what bootstraps will do, it's not a very interesting question in a way. Because it would be true for any subsampling of the data, if there's enough data, that too will have converged into that area. So all the bootstrap values go to 100%, and, you know. So, yes, but. No, it's not inconsistent, but the fact that it's not inconsistent isn't helping much. Yeah. Other similar-ish questions? What I want to do is talk about the very, very first application of statistical methods to phylogenies, which is gene frequencies. And I think I told you when I talked about the history that Cavalli-Sforza and Edwards in the early 1960s were working on this. They came up in the same paper with the first maximum likelihood method, the first parsimony method, and the first distance matrix method, which is an astonishing achievement. And this is not projecting properly. Why is it not projecting properly?
Because when I pushed the button, I didn't push the button or something.
There you go. First it flipped on nicely, and now it's adjusting. Okay. So what they had to do was have a statistical model for how gene frequencies change, because that was their application. In those days, it was blood group, basically blood group loci, which is only a limited number of. Soon after, there was a lot of electrophoretic data. And there was this statistical literature in the late 60s and on into the early 70s, and then it more or less, people stopped working on the problem because nobody had data for it, because although there were a lot of electrophoresis methods being used, mostly within single species, and you got gene frequencies out from that. By the time you got to the late 70s, other methods such as restriction sites methods were coming along and generating more data, and people stopped generating new gene frequency data by electrophoretic means. And the model that Cavalli, Schwartz, and Edward used was Brownian motion. Now, gene frequencies are evolving on a scale that goes from 0 to 1. If you have multiple frequencies at a locus, it's on a sort of, with three of them, it's on a triangle. And it's inside that triangle. So there are limits, and those limits are because if your model of change is genetic drift, which was basically the model they were intending, then the amount of genetic drift is bigger when you have intermediate gene frequencies than when you have extreme ones, and it goes to zero as you get to the end, as it has to do because you're not allowed to go past the end. So what they said was, maybe if we're in the interior region of the gene frequency space and we're not changing too much between, they were using different human population, local human populations, we can consider it as if it were Brownian motion changing at a constant rate, as long as it doesn't get so far, get out near the ends and come to this region where the variance due to drift dies away. So they were approximating. It was a crude approximation. And then there was a literature on, well, given variables that are doing Brownian motion on some scale, how can we make phylogenies by, in this case it was by likelihood, you can also talk about distance methods. And here's a computer simulation showing a small phylogeny of five species evolving by Brownian motion. Now, if you talk to a mathematician about Brownian motion, they get very excited. They say, oh, there's all sorts of weird pathology. Oh, isn't it wonderful? Isn't it fun? But what they're mostly talking about is right in this initial period. When the two populations have split and they're both undergoing Brownian motion, they start at the same point. The horizontal scale is here. And they do Brownian motion, and they crisscross each other. And they crisscross each other an infinite number of times, theoretically, for a finite amount of time, and then they are separated. Nothing special happens there. It's just a consequence of Brownian motion. Well, it turns out that these differences are really not anything you can observe. Doesn't really, your data aren't really telling you intimately what's going on there. You're seeing the net change after a great deal of Brownian motion. So all this pathology stuff is actually irrelevant. The excitement that mathematicians have about Brownian motion is about things you can't really connect here. And what's happening is each one of these lineages is wandering in on the scale. Now what Brownian motion is an infinite number of infinitely small jumps, each of which on average is not jumping either left or right. The mean change is zero. Since they're independent, they have variances. And if you add up the variances, basically the net total change is the sum of these little independent things. Now you may recall, if you've had exposure to statistical theory, that independent small things, except in weird, bizarre cases, add up to a normal, to a change drawn from a normal distribution. The variances of independent things add up. So if you evolve twice as long, in this case it would be sort of a time or pseudo-time scale, you get twice as much variance, which means the standard deviation goes up as the square root of time. So each of these changes on this line and on this line, first of all, they're independent of each other because they're happening in two different populations. And secondly, they are normally distributed with an expectation of the starting point,
and a variance which is proportional to the proportional to time, or proportional to pseudo time, and the amount of variance that accumulates is proportional. There's some sort of proportionality constant, and it's inversely related to the effective population size. Twice as big a population, you'll have half the variance, etc. And here we're simulating them, and what we see is that. Here I go, let's see, can I go, yeah. Here we go, we go up to this point. At this point, this lineage splits. So we have a tree that we're evolving on. It involves this line splitting into two at this point, and then you get independent Brownian motions in the two descendants. Here's a split over here into one line that's going up and ending up at the orange point, which is an interior node, and the other at the gray point. They crisscross a lot. When you have, incidentally, two lines coming together by accident at the same point, you might say, well, momentum would seem to indicate that this one's going that way and that one's going this way, but there is no momentum in the process. Gene frequency processes, if two populations arrive at the same point, you can't tell which one is going to be on the left and which one is going to be on the right next. It's equally likely. As you go one more, this line splits, and there are two more. So here are five tips. What you will see is a horizontal position of only the gray tips. And there's the issue of reconstructing the tree. And an eyeball scan of this will say that's going to be very weak power and very noisy because look how much they're crisscrossing, and that's true. It's when you get a lot of different scales simultaneously, you look at a lot of gene frequency simultaneously, that you can really, in principle, build up power. Now, as I say, people stopped doing this in the late 70s. They kind of lost interest in the 1970s, and people were much more interested in what do we do with molecular sequences. There is, as I'll show you in a moment, a lot of rather bizarre statistical pathology here. And the area kind of was put on the back burner, and it was worse than that, it was put in the refrigerator for quite a few years, for over 30 years. And basically, recently it's revived because people are starting to use single nucleotide polymorphisms, SNPs, and they're starting to look at trees of local populations, adding in a complication of migration between them. People like Joe Pickerel and Jonathan Pritchard have done major, and Carlos Bustamante have done major papers using this kind of model for SNP allele frequencies in human populations. People are also looking at SNPs in closely related species. Now let me just quiz through some of the math. There's lots of equations. This is chapter 20 of the book. I'm not going to hold you for all those equations. I just want you to get the general picture. The first thing is, if you have a tree where you're observing, in this case, seven tips, and there's a Brownian motion scale going horizontally, as I've said, in each branch, the expected change is drawn from the resulting change is, the net change is drawn from a normal distribution with mean zero. If you start at x0, the mean of change is zero. If you start at a point x0, the difference between x9 and x0 is normally distributed with a variance which is proportional to the branch length. And it's independent in different branches. It's independent in simultaneous branches that have split from each other. And it's also the change, the x3 minus x9, for example, that's independent of the previous change. Because once you get somewhere by genetic drift, what happens next doesn't at all depend on how you got there. Okay, so all these differences here are drawn from normal distributions. The total difference up this line is a sum of these normals, so it too is normally distributed, and it too has an average change of zero. Two tips that are near each other on the tree share this part of their history. They share some of the change, but not the rest of it. The net result, whoops, I went the wrong way, is that the total change up to a tip is normally distributed. It's true for both tips. The two tips are covary with each other. And their covariance is equal to the variance accumulated up to their split. Now, you may be a little uncertain as to how to think about covariances because people don't talk about them as much as they do variances. So for the tips, yeah. If they share some branches up to the split, then that creates an amount of covariance. I just point out that variance is the expectation of the square of the difference from the mean. Covariance is the expectation of product of two of those for the two variables. I'm not going to spend a lot of time explaining it right at the moment. And the covariances of these two tips is the variance accumulated up to this point. Well, without going too much into that, the result is the tip values are multivariate normally distributed. The tip values from a single gene frequency in different species are seven variables. It's a seven variable normal distribution. It has, here's a covariance matrix, a table of the covariances. And what you'll see is that those that share a branch get some covariances. Down the diagonal are the variances, which are the V's for the path up to the tip from the root. Now, if you look at this, what you'll find out is it has a structure that's very reminiscent of the topology of the tree. Whoops, that's the previous one. And it looks something like this. If two things split at the root, they have no covariance because they didn't share anything. Those are all zeros. Within each block here, there is a structure of quantities, I'm just calling them letters, that is dictated by the structure of the tree. Well, that's nice. So in principle, you can set up the disjoint distribution of everything at the tip, and we could do maximum likelihood based on that. And this was done by Edwards and Cavalli-Sforza, only they ran into problems. Now I'm going to whiz through the problems and not show you all the algebra so as to catch up a little in time. Also because it's kind of mind-numbing algebra, but there's a more complete explanation in the text if you want to go through it. Let me just give you some verbal conclusions that you can get by looking at small trees. In the text, I talk a lot about a two-tip tree and how one can estimate it. Suppose you take the tree, this two-tip tree, and you think about what you're estimating. You have, let me put it over here. Joke's on me. Just a second. We have two branch lengths. We'll call them V1 and V2. The reason I've been calling so many branch lengths V in this course is because originally the branch lengths were reflected variances. You have the values you observe at the tips. You have a starting value here, X0. You want to estimate for a two-tip tree, there's no issue of topology, you just want to estimate what's V1, what's V2, and what's X0. If you try to do that, there's a nasty surprise that comes up. The surprise is if you say, okay, we'll just take those as parameters, we'll write down this normal thing, we'll maximize it, what you will find is that if you allow either V1 or V2 to shrink to zero,
the likelihood blows up in your face and goes to infinity, which is ridiculous because, you know, certainly it's not infinite amounts of statistical evidence. And that's the problem that that Cavalli-Schwarz and Edwards had. And I'll, in a moment, say where it comes from. But somebody could say, well, they had this problem. In 1967, I was working on my PhD thesis where I worked on this problem, and I found out what I'll tell you in a moment is the source of the problem. A little while later, one of the only other people to have worked on this in a statistical way was Anthony Edwards' student in the early 70s. And she was writing a PhD thesis, and we communicated, and what she tried was saying, well, look, let's impose a clock. Let's say that V1 has to be equal to V2, so we're not allowed to shrink V1 to zero while V2 isn't shrunk to zero. Let's force that. And what she found was that you can make an estimate, but when you work out its bias, it turns out to be only half as big as it should be. That if you have a lot of gene frequencies and you impose that clock, you get an estimate and it converges on something, but it converges on the wrong value. Now, we disagreed about that, you know, fired back and forth papers about whether that was a reasonable thing to do. Sorry, I'm hitting the wrong thing here. The student's name was Elizabeth Thompson. Does anybody know what ultimately happened to Elizabeth Thompson? Big mystery? She's been twice chair of our statistics department. She's here. She's head of one of the heads of the statistical genetics program. She came here in 1985. She and I worked on the statistical pathology of this, and we were about the only two people who read each other's theses during that period. And her thesis, which was quite brilliant, came out as a monograph in 1975. Had a lot of other really good stuff in it. Although on this point, she's doing something, and she justified it, and I said no, and you know, we're still there. but in a nice way. Okay. The problem seems to be that when you're estimating V1 and V2 and X0, that's too many parameters. Now you may say, well, okay, there's two values and three of these, this is a big problem. And the answer is, think of it as you have multiple of these loci. At each locus, you have two observations. That's fine. You have only one V1 and one V2. They apply to all of them. So you might say, it's OK. You're accumulating data with respect to a limited number of parameters. But the starting values, there's one per locus. So if you double the number of loci that you're estimating, you are also doubling the number of parameters that you are estimating. The ratio between data and parameters does not go up infinitely. It goes to 2. And that's a case where likelihood methods often fail, the infinitely many parameters trap, where as you accumulate more data, you have to keep throwing in new parameters at a rate proportional to the data. So this is a case where likelihood can be pathological, and sure enough, it is pathological in this case. So the solution that I proposed in the early 70s in writing up my PhD thesis, and when I finally wrote it up in 1973, was to eliminate estimating the X0, and for a bigger tree, that's eliminating the estimation of all the states of all the interior nodes, something that Cavalli-Schwarz and Edwards tried to do. And then to use only the relative positions of the tips, not their actual positions on the scale, but how different they were. One of them is like 2 units to the right of the other, but we're not going to tell you about where it is on the scale. Now, I'm going to skip through all the algebra. This is doing this... doing the estimation, estimating everything over here, and then finally getting out a likelihood expression, then showing that if you take V1 to 0, it blows up in your face. This is all in the book if you want to look at it. If you impose a clock,
this is what Elizabeth Thompson did. It leads to estimates which you can show are only half, as, ultimately with a lot of data, converge on half what they should. Here is a sort of cartoon of this method that uses only the difference. We if we're doing straight maximum likely, we have some kind of scale, and then we have positions of every species on the scale. But suppose somebody said, I'm not going to tell you where they are on the scale. I'm not going to tell you that. I'm just going to tell you that this one is about one unit to the left of that one. This is about 0.4 of a unit to the right, and this is about one unit to the right. So I'm telling you their relative positions, but they could be anywhere on the scale. Now the question is, have we lost important information? I would argue no, because the process is the same, whether it starts around the number 10, or whether it starts around the number 6, or whether it starts anywhere. What gives you the information about the tree is the relative displacements of individuals on the scale. When you do that, it's called not ML, it's called REML, which has various readings. It's something like maximum likelihood on the relative, on relative maximum likelihood on the error contrast, which is, but there are other, there are other readings. There are other, it's an acronym, but it's in different people's hands, it's an acronym for slightly different things. But REML is this thing where you use relative contrast. Well, that's nice. It's interesting to know. You can show that it gets you the proper, it converges on the proper tree. And here's some algebra, but I'm going to skip all the way through it. And then I'm going to say, okay, so in principle we can get the likelihood. That's nice. You can also do straight ML. The tree gets somewhat distorted, corresponding to that the two species case, getting that tree half as big as it should be. Okay, so it's interesting to hear about that statistical pathology. So really, there are going to be three messages that I'm going to give you about this part of the lecture. One is that if you estimate the interior nodes, you are in trouble, and the whole estimation basically gets pathological. So don't consider, and the other thing to say is, the interior nodes, other than the root, are not parameters. They're just sort of what happened along the way. They aren't defining the distribution in the original process. The one at the root is. So you don't estimate those, things will work better, but they still have this pathology near the root. Second thing to say is, well, you can get out of that using this REML trick. Okay, that's fine, maybe not tremendously relevant. But there's a third that's going to turn out to be important in the next block of material, which I'm coming to right away. And that is, there's an algorithmic transformation you can make of these Brownian motion processes that makes the computation much easier. Now you might say, well, you know, it goes fast enough if you just use the whole matrices and everything. Why bother doing this? And the answer is, we're going to see it do something really interesting when we get to quantitative characters in a moment. Here's a tree with its parameters, and here are the Brownian motion, the observed values. This is something I found in my thesis. If you take these two tips and consider the difference between them, it evolves according to a two-species tree. You can just sort of erase all this. And if you take the difference between them, it has a distribution that depends on V1 and V2. It has an expected value that is zero, the difference between these. Why? Because they both are a result of Brownian motion from whatever the point was here. And which one is bigger than which one? Well, that's just random. So it's going to be a symmetrical distribution, and the average, the expectation will be zero. But then there's a very interesting thing that happens. So you can say, well, let's take the difference between these two tips. Now, it is a common trick in multivariate statistics to take two of your variables and consider the difference between them and some sort of average of them. So we get a, we transform them to two new numbers, one of which is x1 minus x2, and the other is some kind of average, a times x1 plus 1 minus a times x2. It's a weighted average of the two tips. Well, what I found was that if you computed that and you've got, there is a value for a that makes this independent of that. And what the value is when you weight in this average, when the weight is equal to, see if I get this right, V2 over the sum of the of V1 plus V2. Okay, that is a value that gets you just the right weight for those two to be independent of each other. But then there was an even better property that came out of it, which was that when you consider this and ask, well, okay, how does it distribute it? Oh, see, keep pushing the wrong buttons on this. Yeah. Well, how is it distributed compared to the other stuff, X3 and X4, which we've been ignoring? And the answer is, it is just as if it were a tip itself that is on the tree at this point, except that for one little thing. That tip is not the tip here. It's a tip a bit further on with a little extra bit of variance. It has all the right covariances with everything and variances to be this. If you set this delta to equal that thing, this is just the weighted average x1, 2. So that in turn means by making this transformation, we can get two values, one of which is the difference between x1 and x2. Those are evolving as if on a little tree of their own. They are independent of the values of this weighted average and of the other stuff that was left behind. So what you've done is you've factored the tree and said, well, the likelihood of it is going to be the product of two likelihoods, one of which is the likelihood of the Remmel likelihood of this tree, and the other is the Remmel likelihood of that tree. So you can pull two tips off and make a little two-species tree, repair what's left behind by doing some averaging and adding a little branch length. Now you've got this tree. Now what can we do to this tree? Aha, this tree has two branches that are next to each other. We can pull those off, and we can keep going. And in effect, we have factored the tree into, it will turn out n minus 1. If there are 10 tips, we'll have 9 of these trees. N minus 1, other little trees that each have two tips. And the likelihood be, the Remmel likelihood will be the product of the Remmel likelihoods of those. And then you look at it and say, okay, that's nice. It means you can make an algorithm that goes through here rather quickly, gets all these things, gets what the distributions will be, makes it easy to compute the likelihood. But that's fine if you're writing a likelihood program. Why should the user care? Well, for that, we have to go on to the next topic, which is quantitative characters. And I'm going to bring up, well, it's the projection from last time because I haven't modified it yet, but it should be good enough. And say, okay, this Brownian motion machinery can be used for things like SNPs these days. It has some use for that. But what else is it good for? And the answer is, it's good for modeling what's happening in quantitative characters, measurable characters. So now what we're doing is making a tree not based on molecular sequence, not using molecular sequence data, not using gene frequency data, but we're using measurements. We're going to measure the length of my finger and the height of my skull and the height of my ear and, you know, all kinds of numerical measurements. And we get into the issue of people, biologists out there looking at quantitative characters which are controlled by